The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Kennedy Hewitt from Inside the Beltway. Just reading Alexander Sherba tweeting out that Ukraine's defense minister has just announced 40,000 Russians KIA or wounded or missing or defected. That's just kind of stunning. Other headlines about Ukraine. The United Kingdom is going to send 5,000 missiles to Ukraine. Putin is at risk of a coup by the security services, according to the Times of London this morning. Russian president more in danger every week that the Ukraine war continues, according to a whistleblower who spoke to Vladimir Osechkin, an exiled Russian activist. NATO says 15,000 killed, not the 40,000 total casualty number. It's a different source for this. NATO says up to 15,000 Russian soldiers have been killed. That would equal the 10 years of the Afghan war casualty list. Ukrainian orphans are arriving in the United Kingdom. President Zelensky has called for a worldwide rally. World leaders are gathering in Brussels this morning as the Russia claims a small victory in the eastern Ukraine town of Izium. NATO has warned that chemical attacks could affect neighboring countries. BlackRock's Larry Fink says the Ukraine war marks the end of globalization. Now, this is what I love. That's Davos speak. That's New York worried about their investment bets. Lloyd's of London predict Ukraine war will present a major claim, and of course it will. Boris Johnson, who has been probably the best leader in the West on this, says we should go after Putin's gold. I'm all for that. The West could go after Vladimir Putin's gold, Boris Johnson has suggested, being reported in the British Telegraph this morning. He ratcheted up rhetoric ahead of a crunch summit of NATO leaders. Yes, Joe Biden is there. That'll slow things down. The prime minister added, we need to do more, saying the Russian president had already crossed a threshold of barbarism in the way he's behaving. People talk about new red lines for chemical, biological, tactical, nuclear weapons or whatever. Boris Johnson told LBC Radio exactly 1 month after Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. For me, the red line already has been crossed. He's bombing indiscriminately civilian centers. He's causing huge numbers of casualties and wholly innocent populations. NATO is going to push for more defense spending, of course, in the aftermath of the start of the Ukraine war. And Ukraine has claimed that they successfully struck a Russian naval vessel in the Black Sea, which would be great news. I talked yesterday with Captain Jerry Hendricks, retired United States Navy, of why don't they have harpoons. And Jerry, who is loath to criticize anyone who tries to make a good defense product, said maybe they want the Norway anti-ship missile, not the harpoon. The latter made Norway is what we're buying now. And I really don't care what we give them, provided it works. Stoltenberg, who's a very good general secretary of NATO, is going to extend his role in that job for another year. Madeleine Albright, a very classy, great lady, died yesterday at the age of 84. She's my guest many times on the show. Of course, I didn't agree with her on much, but she was a tough, dowdy, wonderful, charming person, and she will be missed. The weapons for Ukraine's fight are flowing across Poland's border, and these small Polish towns are doing everything they can to help refugees and move weapons in and refugees out. Glory to Poland. The NATO alliance has agreed to supply equipment, according to Jan Stoltenberg, that will meet nuclear threats. And the U.S. is asking the EU to take a united stance on the CRP, or they mean the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, at this summit. We just don't know if that's going to happen. Top Kremlin official Anatoly Chubais quits. The most senior member of the Russian government to quit to date. He was the climate czar. So John Kerry has lost a dance partner. Poland is expelling 45 Russians. That's good. Lavrov, the mouthpiece, the mouth of Sorin, says he is surprised by the scale of Western sanctions. Well, then up them. The Moscow Stock Exchange, quote, reopened. I'm using air guitar quotes here because the reopening is very limited. A few stocks that have got residual value, and they're trading up a little bit. Russia looking for a propaganda win, but they're afraid to open the market because people are trying to get all their money out of Russia. They're never going to get it out. They're never going to get it out. Russia has switched gas invoicing to rubles so that European buyers can pay them. Not because they can't. No one will give them hard cash, hard currency. Now, as to Judge Brown Jackson, you know, I've been doing radio for so long, I have covered the confirmation hearings of every member of the Supreme Court currently sitting, plus one. We're now going back through. I was around on the air when Breyer came through. I was there when Justice Thomas came through. Those are the two guys who've been there the longest. Justice Thomas is the senior justice. Hope you're feeling well, Justice Thomas, and you're up and listening. And so I watch closely. I teach con law at Chapman Law. I'm not teaching this semester, but I normally teach in the spring con law one and con law two, and have done so for 25 years. So I watch this with great interest. I love the Dormant Commerce Clause stuff that Mike Lee keeps bringing up. I'm the only person in America. I must tell you, I thought a week ago she would get 65 votes. I thought she would present as an affable, accomplished, very qualified liberal in the mold of Justice Breyer. But Justice Brown Jackson is presented as a nice, affable, very qualified, very smart leftist. And therefore, I could not vote for her. The sentencing conversations are amazing to me. Tom Cotton last night, cut number 18, as the hearing portion ran down to the last rounds of question. Tom Cotton, cut 18.
This is the order you signed, Judge, on April 17th, 2019. In USA v. Hawkins. And it says that you concur with the recommendation of the probation office to return him to residential reentry facility for 180 days and to engage in various kinds of computer monitoring and computer monitoring and search. There's your signature over there, Judge. You really don't remember what?
Senator, that is a very, very common thing that judges do. I've sentenced over 100 people, and supervised release, which is the kind of post-incarceration condition that judges ordinarily impose, is something that's done on a standard form, which is what that is.
I understand you've done a lot, Judge, but none of them have been the centerpiece of your hearing for the last 2 days. Do you really expect this committee to believe that you don't remember what happened in this Hawkins case when it came back before you?
Yes, Senator, I do expect you to believe that's my testimony.
Well, I don't find it credible, Judge.
It's a defining moment. When a senator says, I don't find it credible, that's a way of saying, I don't think you're telling us the truth. And that is a cratering of credibility before the committee. It happened. Democrats said it happened with Brett Kavanaugh, but they were pretending. Republicans talking about, they're not going into her social life. They're not looking at her high school yearbook. They don't know if she had anything, beer, any college, that she goes to church too much. None of that stuff. They're just looking at her judge decisions. And she won't answer questions. At one point, she just wouldn't answer Josh Hawley. And I thought, wow, the floor has fallen out beneath her. You don't answer the senator. You get you got to answer questions for 2 days to get on the Supreme Court. That's it. 2 days. And she wouldn't even answer the questions. I am astonished. Don't go anywhere. Lots more ahead on this Thursday edition from the Beltway. I am Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. The United Kingdom just announced sanctions on 65 new fronts in its effort to cripple the Russian economy. Go Boris Johnson. If you've been watching the hearings all week, I thought I would bring in an expert on sentencing in the federal courts by talking to a former United States attorney. McGregor Scott has done it not once but twice in the Eastern District of the of California, both under George W. Bush and under Donald J. Trump. He served as the United States attorney for the Eastern District of California. McGregor Scott, who goes by Greg, joins me now from California in the middle of the night. Good morning, Greg. Thank you for getting up early.
Hey, Mr. Hewitt, I'm an old infantry officer, so this is what we do, right?
I'm just an old radio host, and I hate doing that when I'm on the West Coast. Greg, I know you watch these hearings. First of all, would you tell people what the Eastern District covers and how many sentencing hearings in a typical month, week? That, you know, give someone a sense of how often Judge Brown Jackson has to do this.
Yeah, so the geography of the Eastern District runs from the Oregon border to the north Los Angeles County line.
Jeez.
And then from the Coast Range over to Nevada. So it's 34 of California's 58 counties. 8+ million people. It's hard for me to give you a specific number in terms of the number of sentencings. Obviously, that's been heavily impacted by COVID over the last couple of years because criminal cases generally ground to a halt for a long time there. But, you know, it's dozens and dozens in a normal setting in a month. And I will tell you that in the George W. Bush administration, our district was at the forefront of the Department of Justice establishing what we called Project Safe Childhood, which was directed right at child pornographers on the Internet exploiting children. So this is an issue that I've been in and around for almost 20 years now at the federal level.
Well, that's why I wanted to talk to you. There are two big questions I have in my mind. One is the sentencing of child porn offenders, and I want parents who are driving to school to be able to protect their kids from this conversation so they get a minute to turn it off. The other big thing is victimless crime. There were no victims in this crime, Senator Cotton. I almost fell out of my chair when the guy had two bricks of heroin laced with fentanyl in his house with a minor in the house, and the judge said there were no identifiable victims. What did you think of that, Craig Scott?
Well, we forget often that in so many different contexts, there are victims. They're just not direct or express in a charge or in a sentence. But when you have, you know, a meth lab in a home with children, when you have major drug distribution going on with children, how many times over the years I've seen criminal cases involving drug manufacturing, drug distribution, and there are small children in the home. And so that's just a nonsensical statement to make that these are victimless crimes when there are small children in a setting.
And when the judge said there's no identifiable victim, are there any acceptable proxies? As a United States attorney, can you bring in, or could a judge summon in someone who's an expert on opioid addiction and death, for example, in the heroin case? Or do you always just have to go on your gut that you know there are dead bodies out there, you just can't connect them with this particular heroin and fentanyl distributor?
Well, it's fascinating you mention that, because especially in the context of the fentanyl crisis that we're facing right now, that so often we have, you know, we think that's the guy that sold it, that resulted in the death of that 17-year-old. But we're, as you know, we are bound by the rules of evidence and a burden of proof. And so we can only really ethically pursue the charges that we believe we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt to a unanimous jury. But that's always in the back of your head. How many people have been killed by this guy selling fentanyl? How many families have been destroyed by a teenager dying because this guy sold fentanyl? But it's not necessarily a direct linkage to a charge that can be brought.
So let's turn over to child porn now. The warning is out there, and parents will have been able to turn off if they don't want their children. I find this so troubling that a judge even has this issue, especially the 3-month sentence to the 18-year-old in possession of child porn of the sort that shocks the soul when it was described by Senator Hawley. What did you make of all that, McGregor Scott, having led the effort under George W. Bush in the Eastern District against child porn, and having gone back for 4 more years as the Eastern District of California U.S. Attorney? What did you think of the whole thing, but especially the 3-month sentence?
It's very troubling, right? This, and you talk about victims of a crime, and this was part of the education program that we had to do to try to make online exploitation of children a priority. There are victims. There are real kids who have been victimized to create this child pornography that is then distributed across the globe via the Internet. And so it's a real identifiable victim, a real identifiable issue. And, you know, we studied all this stuff, and the Department of Justice has, through its facility at Butner in North Carolina, they've done studies. And the question is, can these guys be cured, right? Can they be fixed? And the answer is no when they get to that point. Now, I do have to say that not all child pornography cases are created equal. You can have, you know, an 18-year-old kid with a couple of pictures, and you can have a 38-year-old guy who's got thousands and catalogs and the whole thing and prior convictions. And many times I can only tell you anecdotally that we prosecuted any number of cases involving possession of child pornography where the perpetrator had prior convictions for hands-on child molestation cases. And so I have always believed that there's a direct linkage between those two things.
What did the 18-year-old with videos of 8-year-olds being raped, and that is about as explicit I'm going to get. I could get more explicit, but I'm not going to. He's an 18-year-old. He's got that video. He's got other videos. 3 months? Three months? Couldn't you sentence him to a mental hospital for a couple of years for therapy if you're going to give it a shot?
And this facility at Butner that I just described, that's exactly what they do, is they try to treat these guys. They really, and so there's the United States prison system has a facility that's directed at exactly this issue. Because I can guarantee you that guy's going to be back. There's just no way around it. I've just seen too much of it over the years.
Now, McGregor Scott, would you vote to confirm Judge Brown Jackson?
So I had a feeling you were going to ask me that. Now, so I'm old school on this. I firmly believe that the Senate's role is to advise and consent, not substitute their judgment for that of the president. And the equation in my mind is he was elected. He nominated her. She, at least on paper, is qualified. So the short answer, I think, is yes, with a qualifier, that a lot of things would come out during these hearings that give me pause.
Greg, last week I gave the over-under at 65 because I thought, I looked at a resume, D.C. Circuit. I clerked on the D.C. Circuit.
Right.
And she that's the minor leagues for the Supreme Court. Second most powerful court in the United States. She's very smart, obviously, very accomplished, good mom, wife, community activist. I thought, though, she was a liberal, like Stephen Breyer. She's not. She's a leftist.
No. Well, it's not lost on me, and you know this, of the three names that emerged to be under consideration, she was the one who was being advocated for most zealously by the left-wing groups. And when I thought, when Clyburn and Graham both came out and said, the person from South Carolina, I thought, well, maybe they'll do that. That's a middle ground. But they've chosen the most extreme of the three. And now we're seeing some of that play out in these hearings.
Well, I still think the over-under is at 53 because I believe Senators Colin Murkowski and Romney are the only ones in play here. I can't see Manchin voting no. I'll check with Lindsey Graham on that tomorrow. Let me ask, if you walked into a courtroom, and I don't know if you've argued before the Supreme Court, but lots of U.S. attorneys have, and you saw Judge Brown Jackson up there, do you think he'd have a fair shot as a prosecutor of winning?
It you're a lawyer. It depends on the facts of the case and the law. You can't give a blanket conclusion on that. But I think we all know with these, Justice Sotomayor, you know where she sits when you walk in.
Yep.
And Justice Alito, you probably know where you stand when you walk in. But I'd like to think that the merits of the case as being presented from your side, if it's one of those that can tip, right, that you would prevail on those merits. But we all know that they sit in certain places on that bench.
McGregor Scott, I think the one great value she'll bring to the court, a district court judge for 10 years knows stuff.
Yes. I completely agree in that. And one of my doctrines over the years is an appellate judge must have been a trial judge before elevated to the appellate.
Boy, would that change the United States judiciary? Because that's just not the case. You got 2 minutes. Tell people why trial judges on the court make sense.
Because they know how it really works in a courtroom. When witnesses are late, jurors don't show. I mean, all of the real world stuff that you have to deal with, and then it goes up on appeal, and it's in this rarefied, monastery where everything has to be perfect and pristine, without any sense or appreciation of how it really works in trial practice and in litigation in the courts. And a trial judge, whether it's at the state level or the federal level, who has that experience, that background to understand, well, this is what they meant by that, as opposed to, Jerry Brown appointed all these academics out here to our state Supreme Court, never practiced law a day in their lives. Never.
Uh-oh, you're talking about me, Greg. Well, I mean, I practiced law for 30 years, but I'm not a trial lawyer. I'm an administrative lawyer. I have no idea. I don't even know what side of the courtroom to stand on.
Well, no, I'm saying Jerry Brown appointed these people. But But I really firmly believe that in order, you are far more better prepared and qualified to sit, whether it's a Supreme Court justice, a court of appeal judge, if you have been a trial judge and understand how it works.
I agree. My former law partner, Stephen Larson, Judge Larson, you know, he'd look at me sideways because I didn't know anything about civil procedure. And I suspect, I expect Chief Justice Roberts, when the conference and they've got a Civ Pro issue in front of them or a Fed Courts issue, he's going to assign these right down the line to the district court judge who knows what's going on in the courtroom.
Exactly.
Right? And they're not ideological 100%. Cases usually, right?
Right. That's exactly right. Procedure is straight down the line. That's it.
Yeah, that's what she's going to be doing. McGregor Scott, thanks for getting up early. Former United States attorney. How many years total did you do as a United States attorney?
I was a little over 9, all told.
Wow, and you're still standing. Yeah. My buddy Stephen Cox and Tim Garrison, who you may know from the U.S. Attorney's.
Oh, I know them both well. They're good.
Yeah, they were worn out after short spins, you know, three-year spins.
I got to tell you, that second three-year spin seemed like it lasts about three times as long as that first six under Bush for a lot of reasons. I'll just say that.
Greg Scott, good to talk to you. Thank you. I will hope you will come back again. And I appreciate your getting up so early in California. The Eastern District of California, my friends, ought to be its own state. When we ought to have 51 states because it's just so different from coastal California. It's got nothing to do. You drive the 5 up the Central Valley, it's got nothing to do with the rest of the state. I'm going to talk with Ambassador Michael Oren next about Israel's very unusual role in bringing the Ukraine invasion to an end. It's mind-boggling what's going on. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Michael Oren, former ambassador of Israel to the United States, former deputy minister, joins us now. Good morning, Ambassador Oren. I've got to come right out of the box hot at you. Michael Beckman, great listener, says, when you have on Dr. Michael Oren, tell him, me and most of my Jewish relatives who love Israel, my brother and I have been there many, many times, are very disappointed in Israel's lack of condemnation of Putin and lack of support for Ukraine. How do you respond to Michael Beckman and the many people?
Hi, Hugh. Good to be with you again. I hope he's listening because I have now for 3 weeks been against our government's policy. I think it's the wrong policy. I'd be very nice if Bennett can mediate some type of resolution of this. The chances of that are very small. Leaders of bigger countries have tried and failed. But the question is, what's in it for Israel? What's in it for the Ukraine? The fact of the matter is that Israel, a democratic Jewish state, is not standing four square with another democracy fighting for its freedom, often with Molotov cocktails, against a heinous invader. That opposition is being led by a proud Jew. How do we do that? I don't get it. I understand the need to try to avoid friction with the Russian military in Syria, but you'd be surprised. Only about 4,300 Russian soldiers there, and frankly, they should be afraid of us. The Israeli army is more than twice as large as the British and French armies combined. You know, I have sort of a Dirty Harry approach to the Russian forces in Syria. I think you get the reference.
I do, and they will make Israel's day if they do anything stupid. Well, tell me a little bit about the political problem, because this is now, it's no longer a fig leaf to say you're trying to mediating. That is absurd. The only people that can mediate are the people in the Kremlin who can somehow put Putin under wraps or do a Khrushchev with them. Israel's not going to change his mind. There are considerations at work in the Kremlin far beyond Israel. Is it changing? I mean, you guys have been invaded so many times, you would think you'd be on the side of Ukraine immediately.
Yeah, right now we're the leader of the only democratic country of the world to actually sit and shake hands with this man is our prime minister, and he's shaking hands with a war criminal. So really, it's kind of outrageous. It is changing, but not quick enough. Israel went from not participating in a Security Council condemnation against Russia to voting in favor of a General Assembly condemnation against Russia. Israel, of course, is sending aid of all sorts of type to the Ukrainian people, to the refugees. But we've yet to sign on any major sanctions against Russia. And that puts us in league with countries like China and India, many countries in Asia, but not with the West. And our relations with the rest of the United States are also a strategic interest, don't you think?
Yes. What is going on with UAE and Saudi? Has the Biden administration so estranged our most loyal Sunni allies that they've blown up the Abraham Accords without officially tearing them up?
No, they haven't blown them up. What they're doing is they're afraid. They see that the Biden administration is by all means committed to restoring the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal of 2015. It's going to be a much worse deal. They see that the Biden administration is not only willing to betray its allies in the Middle East to sign this deal, but also to betray the Ukrainian people. Get this, they're going to exempt Russia from the sanctions that are placed on Putin because of Ukraine, so that Russia will be able to keep trading and buying with Iran if Russia agrees to sign the agreement. It's quite extraordinary.
I want to close by asking.
So the Saudis and the UAE and the Emiratis are scared.
Well, they should be. I mean, Iran is now unleashed, in essence. Let me close by talking about Madeleine Albright. I don't know if you had direct dealings with her in the diplomatic sense. Tell us what you think of her and her legacy.
Well, I think she was a middle road Democratic Secretary of State, a capable Secretary of State. I think America generally debased itself by running after Yasser Arafat. My image of Madeleine Albright was during the aftermath of the Taba talks in the year 2000, when they brought Yasser Arafat, I believe it was into the U.S. Embassy in Vienna. He walked out, and she went running after him in her bare feet, you know, saying, close the gate, close the gate. Here was the Secretary of State of the world's greatest nation, running barefoot after this terrorist. I think she was a very cogent thinker. She has an interesting op-ed in the New York Times today, which I very much agree with. She's very personable. I think the Jewish people had a bit of a problem with her. She claimed to discover her Jewishness very, very late in life, which many of us found was not quite believable, but that her parents had fled the Nazis and had suffered under the Nazis in Czechoslovakia. I think for Israel, a mixed legacy. For me personally, I liked her and admired her.
Dr. Michael Oren, very few people can cover the waterfront the way you do. I appreciate your joining me with the Israeli point of view, or one of the many Israeli points of view. By the way, is Bennett losing the country on the Ukraine thing? Is the polling against the government?
It's the strangest thing. You know, we had terrible terrorist attacks 2 days ago.
Yeah, I read it. I talked to people about it.
Someone stabbed four Israelis to death. And this has woken up a lot of Israeli public opinion, saying, why are you running around Europe trying to mediate when we have these problems of home, of terror, and Islamic extremism spreading throughout the southern part of the country?
Michael Oren, more for next week. Naftali Bennett in a tight spot. Don't go anywhere, America. Hour number two of today's show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Oh, that music means Alex Gray is in the house. Alex Gray is a candidate for the United States Senate seat made open by the announcement of the intent to retire of James Inhofe. We're going to miss Jim Inhofe, but Alex Gray is going to be a great candidate and a great senator if he wins. Good morning, Alex. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Alex Gray for OK, and it's G-R-A-Y. That's a horrible Twitter handle, but I guess it's kind of good because Alex Gray for OK actually sticks in people's head.
Well, that's the hope. Thanks for having me back, Hugh.
What is the website for the campaign, Alex Gray?
It is alexgrayforsenate.com.
alexgrayforsenate.com. Okay, Alex, I wanted to talk to you this morning because over at Punchbowl, they have a story that the White House National Security Council, of which you were the chief of staff for a number of years at the White House in the 4 years you served with President Trump, is having a, quote, tiger team, close quote, meet three times a week to talk about the Russian-Ukraine war. First of all, did you guys have tiger teams? I still mock this. I know that the term is out there in the military community, but I think this is absurd.
Yeah, I mean, what we'd like to have as few meetings as possible. You obviously know a lot about how we operated, Hugh. It was a pretty streamlined process where we went from having about 300 people when Ambassador O'Brien and I came in to about 120 when we left on the last day of the Trump presidency. And the goal was less meetings, more decisions, more actual wins for the American people and for the president. And I think it's telling that when the National Security Council leadership was asked after the Afghanistan debacle to explain what had happened, the reaction was not, this was a policy failure, these were the problems we ran into. They justified what happened in Afghanistan by saying just how many meetings of the principals they had held, as if having meetings is somehow, that translates into action, or that means something on its own. So we had a very different framework for what constituted success at the NSC.
Can you comment generally on why we have not sent anti-ship missiles to Ukraine? Because they have hit the Arsk, a tank supply vehicle. It's burning in the port that the Russians seized earlier, and it seems to me the anti-ship missiles would have helped the Ukrainians a lot.
Well, it would have made a big difference. A lot of these things would have made a big difference. And I think, Hugh, what we've seen is probably the worst failure of deterrence in the last least generation, if not two generations. The administration had multiple opportunities to provide real, tangible deterrent forces the way we did under President Trump, when we provided Javelin anti-tank missiles, when we did excess defense article transfers of some pretty sophisticated systems that kept the peace in Ukraine for 4 years. And people will say, you know, despite what the media narrative was under President Trump, you can take a hard look at what happened for 4 years. And there's a reason why Vladimir Putin chose not to take aggressive action in Ukraine or in Eastern Europe from 2017 to 2021. And it's because we had a very sophisticated policy led by President Trump and implemented by his senior team to make sure that the Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian security apparatus had what it needed to keep Vladimir Putin in his box. And unfortunately, beginning with President Biden's assumption of office, we went in the opposite direction. And I think that anti-ship missiles is an example. But we've seen it across a number of areas, and it created a void that the Russians were able to fill.
Now, Alex Gray, I am curious if you come to the same conclusion. It seems to me Boris Johnson and Liz Truss and the frontline states of Poland and others are leading from the front, and that the United States are leading from behind again. I think Joe Biden is actually last to everything in the effort to get Russia to stop. Do you agree with my assessment?
Well, I agree completely that he's leading from behind. I mean, if you look at, again, to go back to the failure of deterrence, and it's obviously continued after deterrence has failed, but by telling everyone what he will not do over and over again, the United States will not get involved. The United States will not implement a no-fly zone, which I don't agree that we should have a no-fly zone. But by always telling our hand, showing our hand to the Putin over and over again, he's taken away any sense of what might be the United States' red line. And he's done something very similar to what President Obama did in Syria. And he's created a policy mix where the United States has no leverage, and where our allies are really left at Putin's mercy. I mean, one of the best, I think, counterpoint to how Biden has conducted this, Hugh, is how President Trump continually conducted foreign policy, whether it was in the Middle East, whether it was with North Korea, where our adversaries truly felt that President Trump was capable of escalating where necessary, and they acted accordingly. And he used that uncertainty to tremendous advantage. And remember, President Trump is the only American president since Ronald Reagan who did not start a serious military engagement. He was passionately committed to reducing American overseas commitments, but he did that through strength and through making it clear that the United States was willing to use force to uphold its interests. And because he was so clear about the willingness to use force, he never had to use it.
You know, I had former President Trump on the air a few months ago. He said he never would have left Afghanistan. He would have held on to the Bagram Air Base, and whenever he left, all of the weaponry would have been destroyed. I had Bill Barr on this week in his memoir, he said, you know, I had my differences with the president, but he would not have ever left Afghanistan. China has sent a senior diplomat to Kabul today to deal with the Taliban. Are you surprised by that, Alex Gray? Would that have happened under Donald Trump?
It never would have happened under Donald Trump. I mean, we've seen this now globally where China's filling vacuums that Joe Biden has created. And I could not agree more with what the former attorney general said and certainly what President Trump said. President Trump understood that Afghanistan, and he had multiple opportunities throughout his presidency to withdraw to zero troops, and he chose not to because he listened to the best advice. He looked at the geopolitical situation, which included what was China doing and what would that vacuum have done vis-a-vis the U.S.-China competition. And he made strategic decisions based on the best information and on our national interests. And I think President Trump, while trying to certainly shift the preponderance of U.S. force to a different, kind of more great power competition angle, I think he would have continued in Afghanistan for a longer period in a more limited capacity, because that made the most sense. And, you know, President Trump, I think one of the things that made him a truly exceptional president was he always made his decisions not based on artificial deadlines, what was necessarily the most popular. His decision making, whether it was foreign or domestic policy, was made on what was in the interests of the United States and the American people. And he did that over and over again.
I'm talking with Alex Gray, candidate for Senate in Oklahoma, 4-year veteran of the Trump White House, concluding his service under President Trump as the chief of staff at the National Security Council. Alex Gray, what does the Oklahoma Senate race look like right now? When is the vote? Is that vote going to happen? I know there was a question before the Oklahoma courts as to whether or not it could be done. What is the status?
Well, the primary election is scheduled for June 28th. There is a challenge in before the state Supreme Court to this question of whether you can have a election for a vacancy that doesn't currently exist. Senator Inhofe has said he will vacate the seat in January of next year, and a suit has been brought about whether that is appropriate under state law. We're waiting to see how the court adjudicates that, but in the meantime, I'm going to continue to go out and hit all 77 counties and make the case for why we need a real Trump America First conservative in the U.S. Senate.
Now, how is the energy production ramping up in Oklahoma in response to the market? Is there anything left to drill in Oklahoma?
There's a lot left to drill. There's a tremendous amount left. And, you know, Oklahoma has a huge amount of capacity that we can continue to take advantage of and exploit and bring to market. And, you know, unfortunately, the energy policies of this administration have been disastrous, not just for Oklahoma, but for the country. And I think nothing is more telling than the fact that the administration's, radical attack on our energy policy has had real foreign policy implications, too. It's not just hitting people in their wallets, which it certainly is. It's not just contributing to inflation, which it is, but it's reducing the ability of our government to operate around the world with flexibility and with freedom to promote the interests of the American people. When President Trump achieved energy independence in 2019, that allowed him to have so much more freedom for the American people on the world stage. It let us focus much more on the existential threat from China, let us focus more on keeping Russia in its box in Eastern Europe. It let us slowly disentangle from these endless wars in the Middle East. And now, because of Joe Biden's radical war on our energy production, we are increasingly dependent on Middle Eastern oil again. And you look, Hugh, at the President of the United States, who is not getting his phone calls returned by the leaders of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, who is frantically calling to leaders in the Middle East, begging for help lowering world oil prices, when just 3 years ago we were energy independent. I mean, it's absolutely shameful.
Last question, Alex Gray. That last thing, the UAE and Saudi Arabia not returning phone calls, to what do you put their hostility to Team Biden down to? I think it's the Iran deal, but what do you think?
It's a combination, I think, Hugh, of the Iran deal and the administration's The administration's foreign policy in the Middle East has been all over the map. You know, they made a decision that they were going to take the Houthi rebels in Yemen off of the terrorist designation list, which was absolutely a shameful decision, and was followed very quickly by the Houthis launching attacks against civilians in the UAE and Saudi Arabia. I think the Saudis and the Emiratis are already showing how they feel about that by exploring increased relations with China. And, you know, these things don't happen in a vacuum, Hugh. I mean, one of the things President Trump understood, all these things were interconnected. And the Biden administration, unfortunately, hasn't played a game of global chess. They're playing checkers.
Alex Gray, thank you for joining me. Alex Gray for OK. Alex, G-R-A-Y, F-O-R-O-K is his Twitter handle. What's the website for the campaign, Alex?
It's Alex Gray, F-O-R-Senate.com.
Alex Gray, F-O-R-Senate.com. Alex, thank you very much. Continue to follow that race very, very closely. Don't go anywhere. Jim Talent coming up. We'll continue to talk about why is deterrence collapse, as Alex Gray just said. And please do not forget, over at HughHewitt.com, the Food for the Poor button is at the top. Help Ukraine. Hundreds of you are stepping up. Hundreds of you are calling. Thank you. Thank you, every one of you. Your money's going directly into the lifeline that is providing support and sustenance and food for the people of Ukraine. That banner, Help Ukraine, is displayed across the top of HughHewitt.com. You see the Relief Factor button down at the bottom of the Salem News Channel. That's always on display. Helping Ukraine at HughHewitt.com is right at the top. Jim Talent is next, America. Stay tuned on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Jackie Heinrich reporting. President Biden has arrived at the NATO meeting. He is the only world leader who has not stopped to speak to the press so far. I am not surprised by that. I wonder if Senator Jim Talent, former senator from Missouri and now with the Bipartisan Policy Center, is surprised. Good morning, Senator. Joe Biden's quiet. I think that's probably good for the world.
Yes, I tend to agree. I'm sure he'll have to eventually speak to the press, though.
Tell me, what do you make of this morning? The Orsk is on fire in a Ukraine port seized by Russia because it got hit by non-anti-ship missiles. This the bombardment the Ukrainians. Why haven't we sent them anti-ship missiles, Jim Talent?
We should be sending them whatever systems will help them in this conflict without worrying about whether we call them defensive or offensive. The bright line test should be, we're going to support the Ukrainians in this. We're not going to involve our own forces. And so we should support the Ukrainians with whatever conventional weapons would be useful, whether that's fighter aircraft or the rest of it. It's not escalatory. I've said from the beginning on this show and other shows, you don't want to climb the escalatory ladder with Putin, but you do that when you engage your own forces or NATO forces, not when you support the Ukrainians.
And we may not have a choice if he does anything crazy, but let me ask you.
We have to respond, but then he's climbing it, right?
He's climbing it, right.
Yeah.
Now, Senator, I think the one good thing that has come out of this is that NATO has decided, well, the U.S. is out of the game for 3 years with Joe Biden. We'd better figure it out, and Boris Johnson is leading. What do you make of my assessment?
I agree that the British response has been very, very strong. We have to wait to see with the Germans. And, you know, they're preparing plans to ration natural gas. So the issue is whether their energy policy has put them in such a corner that they cannot do what they've said they now want to do, which is to reassert some kind of a leadership role in Germany. You know, I wrote a column about 5 years ago, about how the German army was training with broomsticks instead of rifles. I'll send it to you if you want.
Oh, please.
Because they'd allowed their defenses to decline to the point where they couldn't supply their tanks with machine guns. So they've got a long way to go, and they've got to do it without, you know, with complete energy insecurity because of their policies.
Our chancellor, the new Chancellor Scholz, who is from the left of Angela Merkel, I'm beginning to think, though, Angela Merkel wasn't really a center-right conservative like she held herself out to be. She's a pacifist, almost, in what they've done in Germany. Scholz is having none of this, but he still won't cut off Russian energy. He won't do that, Jim Talent.
Yeah, well, it's hard to use economic tools or against an aggressor on whom you are economically dependent. you'd think that would have occurred to people before this. Energy production and energy security is absolutely vital for the Western democracies if they're going to defend themselves. And the best way to do that is to produce yourself. But also you can rely on sources that are not authoritarian, like the United States, or in our case, if we were to agree to the Keystone Pipeline, that would make sense also. You know, so much of this really just is common sense, right? I mean, you want your people to have access to reliable and affordable energy.
Energy is freedom. I've said it a million. Energy is freedom. Alex Gray was just talking about this. Oklahoma Senate candidate. Oklahoma can produce more oil and gas. So can Texas. So can Canada. We need to step up and do that. Jim Tellen, I got to ask you about Judge Brown Jackson in the hearing. I have never before seen a nominee refuse to answer a question by a senator as she refused to answer Josh Hawley yesterday. Have you?
Well, I think the senators have done us a service here, because I think what they have shown is that Judge Jackson, I think she's sincere in this, okay, because she's been very consistent, believes that criminal defendants are basically the victims. In other words, that they are the victims of society rather than the other way around. And if that's what you believe, okay, you're going to cause a lot of pain and a lot of damage, first and foremost, to innocent people, because you're going to get the crime, kind of crime wave we have today. But also, and this is what's so ironic to you, the one chance these guilty defendants have to a better life is to admit their own responsibility for their own actions. If they don't do that, there is no way they can be rehabilitated. They have to want to be rehabilitated. And if you're a judge apologizing to them for their prosecution, all you're doing is feeding the perception that they are the victims and they're never going to change. That's what's so ironic about this. If she wants to help these people, she needs to drive home the idea that they're at fault for their own actions. And then you can offer them hope and help, okay? But this attitude is exactly what's producing this crime wave today, and I think the Senate's done a good job of bringing that out.
Well, Democrats are soft on crime. And by the way, Judge Jackson is going to be Justice Jackson. I can't see a Democrat voting against her. It might be 51-50. It might be 51-49 if they peel off one of the Republicans. But she's soft on crime. What do you think the final vote will be, Jim Tallent?
Well, if I was betting, what did Tom say yesterday? Tom Cotton. 49.5 over under.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like it to be 50-50. I would vote against her largely because of her position on criminal justice and because she refuses to say what a woman is. By the way, if she had a hearing where somebody was testifying that a person was a woman, would she require them, the witness be qualified as an expert biologist?
Great question. Too late, but that's why we liked it when Jim Tallent was in the Senate. Great question, Jim Tallent. Oh, I wish that had been asked. Don't go anywhere, America.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.